This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season, and Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code Sit Down when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus, up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's a sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code Sit Down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy. Football's coming.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, joined as always by our co-host, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, good to talk to you as always. We get another week, another sit down, and I'll tell you what, I felt a little breeze in the air today. I got a feeling the hot weather's over. Soon it's going to be Thanksgiving. It's Christmas. But as the world turns in the mafia, another big show planned today. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, brother. I'm envious of you with the weather turning because I'm down here in Florida where we're swamp season. So all I do is track tropical storms and try to stay indoors as much as possible.
Yeah, it was in the high 70s today. felt great. You know, in a month, it'll be cooler at night. So,
looking forward to it. Brother, we're recording this podcast at like 9 o'clock at night. It's 80 degrees right now.
Yeah. Well, what is it here? It's, it's like 71. I mean, it's nice and cool, you know, nothing crazy, but, another big show. As I said, I always say that we always have a big show. How could we not? We're talking about the mafia. I mean, there's always something great to talk about. We're going to talk about a show today and do a show today about Tony Ducks Corallo. And, you know, I'm so happy we're doing this show because, you know, there's not a lot known about Tony Corallo. He's kind of an elusive figure. I mean, he was a really big time boss for really the heyday of the mob in the public eye in the 70s and the 80s. You know, a lot of people don't know much about Tony, but I feel like we always bring out Blackjack the best of the info. And I think we got some really good stuff today. So we're going to kind of get into him and really was someone that from his early age really understood that labor racketeering was where the money was. And we're going to talk about some of the things that he did and kind of how he was a really great boss. And really, once he went away, the Lucchese crime family is really never the same. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. But before we get to that, we have a great Q&A. We've got some great questions today sent in by our friends of ours on Twitter through DM. Just some great questions that I'm looking forward to getting into. Obviously, want to thank Thrive Fantasy. As always, you heard the message at the beginning. Thank you for them for sponsoring the show. And I got another sponsor, Blackjack, I grabbed as well. So we're moving and shaking here at the Sit Down, trying to get our names out there. And we're doing
excited about the new sponsor. The new sponsor is, if you enjoy this show, as we know thousands of you do every week, you are going to really enjoy the new sponsor. I love their stuff, Jeff. I know you do. Yeah. You're going to really want to check it out.
Well, and this is a big time episode too, and I'm glad we're announcing these things because this is our 20th episode. It's been 20 episodes. We passed 240,000 listens with this show. And remember, we're only 20 episodes old. So
I didn't know it was our anniversary, Jeff. I didn't even get you a gift. I feel like an asshole.
Yeah, I didn't get you a gift either. I got you a gift of a great show. There you go. Let's get into some questions here for the show. 20th episode of the sit down. First one from Twitter. Most mobsters are regarded as evil. Were there any that were regarded as genuinely nice guys? You know, this is interesting because I would say that most mobsters are pretty genuine, nice guys. I think they have an evil streak to them, but I wouldn't say, I would say there are more like, they're less evil people. Like there were definitely Tommy Pateras and Anthony Miras and Mad Sam DeStefanos out there. But like, I think most mobsters are generally just normal people. They just have interesting careers. I mean, let's be honest, Blackjack, if during the 80s when John Gotti was the boss of the Gambino crime family, I think if you were on Mulberry Street and he was out front, I'm sure he could probably go up to him and shake his hand and he'd welcome you coming up to him. Like,
I think you're right, Jeff. And I think there's a lot to that, right? And I think that's a really kind of a deep question in some ways, because I think all of us obviously have the capability to do things that are, I'll say, against the law, for lack of a better term. But it doesn't mean you're necessarily a bad guy, right? I mean, like, yes, you're right. There's Tommy Pateras, there's Greg Scarpas, there's guys like that that are what they are. But I think you take a guy like a John Gotti, a Carlo Gambino, who we talked about last week. You know, Carlo Gambino seemed like a pretty well-loved figure in all respects of his life. And John Gotti, again, I know we mentioned it in the episode about Carlo. If you ask John Gotti's neighbors, you know, save the one in Howard Beach, what they thought of him, they'd say John was the nicest, most generous guy they ever met. You know, John threw these massive block parties. If they ever needed anything, if they had a sick relative or they lost their job, you know, John was there. I think a lot of these guys, they're just people, right? They're not, most of them are not monsters. They're just people. They've got good parts to them and bad parts to them, but the bad parts of them usually are restricted to their line of work.
Yeah, I think you'd much rather have a tough time figuring out the really evil people. And there are some really evil, deranged people. I mean, you know, Tommy Patero or Casso or guys like that. But, you know, I think for the most part, these are just regular people. They have regular lives. They have regular jobs. You know, but then they have these streaks and do things that, you know, most people don't do, like bookmake or extort or whatever. As far as though, one thing about The Sopranos I always loved is they kind of showed that the mob, they are just normal people at the end of the day. They go home and eat ice cream and their wives yell at them and that kind of shit, you know? I guess to answer this guy's question, though, there are a couple of guys that I'll highlight that I know that were truly good people, I think, at the end of the day, and they just had, like, weird jobs. One of the guys that people kind of always raved about is kind of a little known guy, but he was really powerful. If you know anything about him in Chicago, guy Murray Humphreys, he was a really big labor racketeer. At one point, he was one of the more important people in the Chicago outfit. He was the basis of Tom Hagen in The Godfather. You know, no one had a bad word to say about Murray Humphreys. He had a quote one time. He said, "Go out of your way to make a friend instead of an enemy." And he was a guy that really was all about his community, helping people, helping poor people, and really kind of try to live, even though he did a lot of things that weren't necessarily looked good upon, he always tried to do the right thing. And, you know, we've talked about Al Capone. He did a lot of things for the community. A lot of these guys, if you walked up to them, I think they're nice people. They do have the evil streaks to them, which, you know, you have to remember who you're actually dealing with here. All right, let's move on. What do you think would have happened if Neil De La Croce became boss instead of Castellano? Would it have been a better or worse situation in the long run for the Gambino crime family? Would Paul have retaliated, and would a war have broken out?
I love
First of all, it was never going to happen because, as we talked about last week, Carlo was never going to pick Neil. It just wasn't going to happen, even though he may have been more qualified. Carlo was a blood guy. He wanted to put his cousin in control. Now, I think you would agree, Blackjack, that, you know, Neil was going to die eventually, even if, let's say, he does become boss. Paul would have then become the boss, And yes. John Gotti would have did the same thing.
Well, here's where I'll take a little bit of a different tack. I agree that it was never going to happen, right? Like, it wasn't going to happen. And if it did happen, let's just set reality aside for a moment and say it did happen. No, I do not think a war would have broken out, because I think most of the guys on the street would have been very much in favor of Mr. Neal becoming the boss. So no, I don't think there's a war. I do think that history may change a little bit. And the reason I say that is because, again, you have to factor John Gotti into this equation. You're right, Jeff, that Mr. Neal, if he becomes boss, still probably dies before John Gotti is anywhere close to ascending to that throne. So it goes to Paul. I don't know, though, if with more time and more seasoning under Neal, I don't know if John Gotti takes the step to kill Paul Castellano. I don't know if that relationship goes that direction, because, you know, one of the things that John Gotti really kind of set him off was when Paul didn't show up to Mr. Neal's funeral, right? I mean, it really pissed him off. I don't know if John Gotti goes that route. And if John Gotti doesn't go that route, I don't know that he becomes the figure we know of him, because we know John Gotti had an ego as big as All Outdoors, and then committing the biggest gangland execution since Albert Anastasia just made him feel untouchable. So I don't know. I don't know if that trajectory changes for Gotti and for Castellano. I think that you're right. Castellano ultimately becomes the boss, but I don't know if Gotti winds up being in a spot where he feels like he has to put a hit out on him.
Well, look, I think ultimately Neal would have died, and that would have meant Paul been boss, and it would just been like it ended up being. I think John would always thought he would be the leader at some point. I think he would have did what he had to do, but it's a good question. I don't think it never would have happened, and it didn't happen, so we don't know, but you know, always good to play what if. What mobster never had the makings of a varsity athlete? I mean, I have a pretty easy answer to that. And look, I want to make this clear. I respect this guy. I actually know some of his family members. I have had conversations with him. I think he's a good guy. I think he's super smart. John Gotti Jr., for sure.
Whoa.
I think Jr. is a guy that, you know, I really think just adored his father like any of us do. And he said before he'd have followed him into the gates of hell. And, you know, I think Jr. was a guy that probably should have went another way with his life. And I think now that he has, I think, you know, he's better for it. Jr. was a guy that, you know, obviously had some trouble with things. I think he was kind of vaulted into the limelight and made to be the boss quickly. I don't think he would have been there if not for his father. And I don't know if anyone ultimately always respected him. I think they respected his father, obviously way more than him, but I would probably say him. Did he do some good things? Yeah, of course. But I think he made some of the same mistakes that his father made. Not that I don't think his father was an icon. He definitely was. But, you know, John Sr. made some mistakes, obviously. You know, John Sr. acted a lot different than Carlo did or Tony Corallo or Salerno. So I would probably say Junior Gotti in this instance.
I think that's a tough one to argue against, because – and I think you're being kind to Junior. I think that Junior was – an idiot for the most part. I'll say it.
I will say, though, he's a really – I love hearing him speak now. I think
I like when he does documentaries and sit-down interviews, but I think he was a fish out of water.
Yeah.
Like, he was not a guy who was meant for this. You hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, he followed his father. And I get that, right? A lot of people do that. It's natural. You know, that's your dad. That's your hero. Especially when your dad is a guy like John Gotti, right? Like, you want to be like that. But, man, you look at some of the early stuff with Junior involved, and it's cringeworthy. Like, he feels like a fish out of water to me. You mentioned The Sopranos earlier. It kind of reminds me of, like, the very early episodes with Chris Moltisanti when he's trying to find his footing, and he's just, like, not –
struggling.
He's just not part of the crew, right? Like, he's there because Tony's his uncle or his cousin, whatever you want to call it, but he's not really part of the crew. It's an awkward fit, and I think that Junior is the easiest answer there.
Yeah, 100%. Was prison for mobsters really like they made it seem in Goodfellas? No. I mean, listen, I think in the 60s, 70s, even today, I think you know, there are certain facilities where mobsters probably live a little bit better. I think every federal facility, if you have money, you can do things.
That's 100% true.
You know, the hacks are not, they really just want no trouble, you know, and if that allows, you know, if you have to allow some things to go on, you'll allow it because you just don't want them fighting and rioting and all that sort of shit. Do I think they had full course meals and they were in their own units? No, I don't. No. And Michael Franzese and people that have been in prison that are in this genre now that speak about it will tell you that. Do I think there's, you know, obviously the thing that a lot of people don't realize, and we've talked about it on this show, you know, there's certain levels of prisons that people go to. Do I think that Vincent Basciano down at USP Atlanta is living the same way that Michael Franzese did at Terminal Island? No, of course not. You know, and there are really tough federal prisons, but as we know in the federal system, really like any other blackjack, it is truly, truly segregated as far as every group hangs with each other. And that's just how it goes. And let's say you go to FCI Raybrook in New York, you're going to find some people if you're connected that are connected as well. And you're all just going to hang out together. Yeah. You know, the blacks hang out with the blacks, the bankers hang out with the bankers, you know, the Mexicans hang out with the Mexicans. It's truly segregated. So, you know, do I think they get some things? I know of a guy, blackjack in Philadelphia, a guy, Angelo Lutz, he's talked about it. He did, I think, 9 years, a lot of it in Michigan. And he would talk about how, you know, they would have certain certain religious days, you know, Italians and Catholics would have, and they'd do, you know, they'd do different meals and things of that nature. I have a good friend in federal prison. He talks all the time about, you know, they have parties and different things. And, you know, I think you really just try to get on as best you can. And I think if you have money, whether you're a drug trafficker or a mobster or whatever, you're going to find a way to do a bit better than someone that maybe doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly right. Right. Like prison is not unlike any other facet of the world in that money changes things. Right. And you're exactly right. I've dealt with a lot of different prisons, state, federal. The guards, for the most part, just want things to be quiet. That's it. They don't want problems. And so if you're going to get along and you're going to go along with what they say and you're going to slip them some money every now and then, will they allow you some liberties? Yes. Are you going to have imported lobsters brought in and all this stuff? No, you're not. Will they allow you some, you know, liberties? Yes, they will. But, you know, they're not going to open up the doors of the prison for you. That's just not going to happen.
Right. And every facility has something called a commissary, particularly in the feds, where you can truly buy whatever you want. I mean, right. You can buy hamburgers. You can buy, you know, right. Twinkies. You can buy whatever you want. You know, I think to think that, you like you said, you can bring lobster in and you can typify the pan with garlic that you use a razor blade to cut. I don't think that's going on. But, you know, again, most facilities. And look, I think that's one of the big farces about America, blackjack, is that, let's just say in the federal system, 90% of people that commit crimes, let's say if they're a first time offender, they're going to be perfectly fine in prison. They're not going to get hurt. They're not going to get raped. Nothing's going to happen to them. There are different levels. Now, correct. As you go to different levels, you're obviously a more hardened criminal and you're going to go to tougher places. But
you're right. And I'll say this, state prison is enormously different.
From sure. Federal. Sure.
State yeah. prison can be a rough go.
Right.
Federal prison is generally highly supervised, highly regulated. Like you said, there's all the different levels. They generally group offenders based on those levels correctly. It's not what's made out in TV.
So there you go. If you're going to commit a crime, which we don't federal. Tell you to commit a federal crime. And hey. If you're going to commit one, make sure it's your first one and make sure it's some like wire fraud or, you know, I don't know.
Listen, we always say it in the legal system, there's a saying, Jeff, if you're going to do time, do it the federal way.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, generally they're not going to send you to Big Sandy or ADX. So you'll be okay. And you're not going to go for 78 years. You're going to go for 8 months or something. And it would probably be more of like an adventure anyway. All right. By the way, blackjack, let me ask you quickly, let's say tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock p.m., the federal bus is picking you up.
Whoa.
You got to do 6 months in a low. How much money do you need to do that right now?
25 grand.
Yeah, that's probably what I would say as well.
25 grand. I mean, six months.
4K a month.
6 months in a low security federal prison. You're talking a country club, essentially, right? Like that's what we're talking about. Well, that, I mean, they call them that, but that, yeah, it's not a club joke. Fed. Like if you, the most famous incident of it is Jordan Belfort, right? The Wolf of Wall Street. And he wrote about it in his book, where he was literally out playing tennis every day. Like,
it, I mean, still sucks, though. I mean, you still get told what to wear. And
listen, you're not leaving. You can't leave. There are still very strict rules. But could I do 6 months in club fed? Yeah, I could. If you're going to give me $25,000 tax-free, I could do 6 months.
Okay, what about MCC 6 months?
Nope.
What would you need?
We're talking seven figures.
Okay. Yeah, that's smart.
Seven. All right. Because I'm not. The difference between the federal system and the state system is enormous. You walk into a county jail in most counties and they're shitholes. Okay.
Yeah.
You walk into a federal prison, they are not that. They're just not.
Yeah. They're all pretty new and that kind of thing. All right. Couple more. Did most of the bosses during the peak of the mob have a person whose only job it was to launder money for them 24/7? Also, do you guys truly believe it was better to be loved and respected than feared in the mafia? Well, obviously, the second part of your question has a lot to do with Machiavelli. Yeah, look, I think it's better to be, I think you, like Sonny said in the Bronx Tale, you want to give your guys just enough where they need you, but not too much where they, are fat and happy, or not a little where they're wanting to kill you. You kind of have it all in the middle. I say a joke, I'm funny, but I'm not that funny. It's love that it's fear that keeps them loyal to me. You want to be have a little of all of it. You want to be feared. You want to be loved. You want to be kind of in the middle.
Yeah, it's, Michael Scott, I think, said it best in The Office when he said, "I want my employees to fear how much they love me."
Exactly. Well said. Do most of the bosses during peak of the mob have a person that did that? Yeah, look, I mean, you got to remember, these are like Fortune 500 companies. That's why they have businesses. That's why they have legit businesses to funnel money through. Were there people that were laundering? Sure. I mean, there are associates. There are people. I mean, go look at any chart of the mob. Even today, you'll see people that don't look like they're of Italian descent that are part of it. A lot of those people are launderers, or they're runners, or they do stuff. So yeah, I would imagine there were people that were doing that for sure. Love the show. Are there any informants you agree with, or is a rat a rat? Well, look, by the definition, a rat is a rat. You cooperate against the people that you're supposed to be loyal to. After you take an oath, you're a rat. Are there any people, Blackjack, in the scheme of history of the mob that I would say, you know what, I get it? Not many, but yeah, there are a few. One of which would be John Martorano. We talked about him during the Whitey Bulger episode. Blackjack, we have to remember, John Martorano killed 20 people, okay? 20. He admitted to it. But John Martorano eventually would cooperate against not only Whitey Bulger, but Stephen Fleming. And when we look back on that, do we knock John Martorano for cooperating? He was literally being ratted on for like 30 years by Whitey Bulger and John Connolly and that shitbag Stephen Fleming. So when I look back, John Martorano, was he a rat? I don't really look at him the way I look at like other people. I don't look at him like I look at John A. Light or no. Sam Gravano.
No. Listen, there are degrees here, right? Like you just mentioned Whitey Bulger. At the end of our Whitey Bulger episode, we had a conversation about whether he's a rat or not. And I said, no, you said yes.
But he's still informed against people.
But my whole thing with Whitey Bulger is, if I put myself in his position, I view as what he did as a business transaction. I don't view it as ratting because, and here's why. If I'm Whitey Bulger, I'm giving you pennies in exchange for dollars. I'm giving you real low level shit. And in exchange, you're letting me run this massive enterprise because the government is looking the other way. You're essentially buying their cooperation with low level stuff. So yes, is he giving them information? Certainly. But is he giving them anything of importance? No, he's not. And he's still allowing this enterprise to flourish. You know, Joe Massino's another guy you could have this conversation about. Joe Massino flipped, but he flipped at the end of his life to save his wife and his mother's house, and he really gave the government very little in return.
Well, I mean, he but again, what I'm trying to make the point of here is all the guys you're talking about, whether it's Messina, Bulger, whoever, they all informed on other people to get out of things. In John Martorano's case, he truly just informed on two or three people that literally were doing it to him for years.
I agree with you that Martorano is a separate case.
Wouldn't you say he's more a witness as opposed to an arrest?
Yes. Yes, I don't think Martorano qualifies as a rat. I think you can have the discussion about Messina and Bulger, and you could argue yes, but I just think Whitey Bulger was making a smart business decision. Like, he was allowing this organization to continue to operate by giving the feds, you know, chicken feed. I think it's a smart move to do. I don't view that as Sam Gravano or you know, Elite or any of the other guys we've talked about, because those guys were simply saving their own skin. Like, that's all they were out for, was saving their own ass. They got busted and they were done. I don't view Whitey Bulger that way. I think Whitey Bulger made a decision that if I was in his shoes, yeah, it's probably smart to do, because you're going to keep this thing up and running.
Yeah. And again, I think ultimately, to kind of answer this person's question, yeah, I guess everyone is a rat in certain instances. They informed, they gave up information. But I think there are different levels of informants, and maybe sometime we'll do a flow chart on who the biggest and worst and the ones that weren't. This is kind of an interesting one. So I have an uncle that was connected, great uncle that was connected. I heard he was close to some big people. What do you know about Ciro Perone? So I actually know a lot about Ciro Perone. I don't know how much you do, Blackjack, but this is a guy that really messed around with a lot of really big people. Ciro Perone was a guy that was part of the Genovese crime family. He was really in the life for a long time, was in a lot of big time businesses, worked under Matty Ionello in Manhattan. Matty Ionello obviously owned Umberto's. He was big in Times Square. Ciro was big in labor racketeering, bookmaking, skimming money from businesses. And he did have some good businesses as well, some legit ones. He was big in the Feast of San Gennaro. And he actually had a interest in Don Pepe's, which is a restaurant. He was pretty big in that business. He would be in the life for a long time. There's actually some pretty cool stories about Perone. I tweeted about one a couple of weeks ago, Blackjack. When he was 19 years old, 1940, he got jammed up in a check cashing robbery. And he went to the case, and he got, I think, 7 years. And at the time, his Italian mother wailed, like started screaming, crying. The judge hit her with contempt of court and gave her 30 days. And Perone got furious and said, "You cocksucker, I'm going to cut your balls off." And it was a wild story. He ended up going, you know, got into the life, did a lot of different things, as I said. But during the 80s and into the 90s and even the 2000s, he had never been jammed up in anything. He'd only did that little time when he was young. But they started bugging Don Pepe's one night, and it was him, John Iannuzzi, and Ralph Scopo III, whose father, Ralph Scopo Jr., was actually a pretty big member in the Colombo crime family. He was the creator of the Concrete Club. They were in a Don Pepe's one night having dinner, and they were talking about Growing Up Gotti, the show on TV at the time. And they were talking about how embarrassing they were, and they're a disgrace to Italians, and that Ralph Scopo couldn't even mention it because he was so disgusted for his friend John Gotti, and that, quote, they were kind of rolling around in their graves thinking about it. And Perone was caught on wiretap saying that they looked like females. Eventually he went to prison. He died in 2011, but he's a pretty interesting guy, Ciro Perone. So you have a pretty interesting lineage there. You might be able to even write a book about it. If you ever want to write a book, let me know. I'll help you out. But yeah, I always thought Ciro Perone was an interesting guy. You recently did a video about the Joe Gallo hit. Do you not believe NYPD detectives and others? No, I don't. I don't think Frank Sheeran killed Joe Gallo. I don't think Frank Sheeran killed Jimmy Hoffa. I think Frank may have been at the Jimmy Hoffa hit, but I don't think he pulled the trigger. And I especially don't think he killed Joe Gallo.
No.
If you read the witness accounts, if you read a lot of things regarding the situation, particularly with people that knew the Gallows and were directly connected with them, people had gotten sick of Joe Gallo. He obviously did, you know, some of the things that they said he did, but he was hobnobbing with the elite. He was trying to write books and do movies, and he was just someone that people were getting sick of. And if you read the witness accounts directly from Gallo's wife and bodyguard, they both made it a point to say that the individuals that shot Joe Gallo, by the way, it was more than one person. The lead shooter was, quote, in his mid 5 foots, in his 40s, and Italian, none of which described Frank Sheeran. Frank Sheeran was a big guy. He wasn't Italian at all. They would have known. And the bodyguard actually made it a point to say he knows for a fact that Carmine DiBiase, a.k.a. Sonny Pinto, was the shooter, and he shot at least 6 times at Joe Gallo. So, yeah, I don't believe Joe Coffey. I don't believe some of the NYPD detectives. And when they said that, they may have not had some of the information that's out now. I think the film The Irishman is great. I just think some of it is dramatized. He did not kill Joe Gallo.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, when you're dealing with a movie, there's going to be artistic license taken. I think that everything we've talked about with the Gallo hit indicates Frank Sheeran was not involved. And, you know, it's just one of those things. It becomes easy as time goes by, right? Like, to just start saying, oh, this guy did this. Maybe he did this. He did this. It's not accurate. When you are exactly right. You go back and look at what the witnesses that day said. It does not fit Frank Sheeran at all. So, no, I don't think Frank Sheeran was involved there.
One more question. This is actually a good one. This guy sent this a while ago. I didn't get a chance to answer it, but I want to answer it now. He says, hey, guys, really enjoy the show. Can you tell me anything about West Virginia mob history? Was there ever any connected people there? Interestingly enough, there was.
Yeah.
You know, obviously being close to Pittsburgh, it had a lot of ties to Pittsburgh back in the day. There was a guy, Paul Hankish, that was a big time mover and shaker in West Virginia, particularly in Wheeling. One of his main rivals was a guy called Bill Leas. They called him Big Bill Leas. He was a Greek guy. He was about 450 pounds. And he was born in 1900 and really controlled, you know, obviously bootlegging, illegal gambling. He controlled pretty much all of vice in Wheeling. And at one point, he actually ordered Paul Hankish to be killed. And Paul would end up losing his legs in a car bombing that was done in part from Bill Leas. But Bill Leas eventually would acquire all sorts of wealth. And in the 40s, West Virginia actually became a pretty big gambling destination. Bill Leas would acquire a place called Wheeling Downs.
Mm-hmm.
And would turn it into kind of an emerging hotspot for gambling. There was a lot said about Bill Leas. He had a big time connection with Detroit and the Purple Gang. And he was obviously very kind in his community. He would also take care of charities and give away turkeys. And he was big with the community. He eventually in the 40s would get pinched on tax evasion, and the government would move to deport him. They couldn't prove, though, if he was born in America or over in Greece, and he would end up dying at the age of 69 due to, I believe, his weight. He was a large individual, but, you know, as far as now, there is none that I know of. But yeah, there was an interesting underbelly in places like Wheeling back in the, you know, really the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
West Virginia has been one of those states that it flies under the radar in a lot of ways, but if you look at it geographically, right, it sits and it borders states like Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia. It's got a lot of different areas that are very close to it. It's remote, so it's ideal to conduct any sort of business because there's drive around West Virginia. You'll see what I mean. It's incredibly remote. And you mentioned gambling. I can tell you, Jeff, even in modern times, when I was in college in Washington, D.C. in the early 2000s, we would get in the car and drive to West Virginia to gamble because you gamble there at 18 and you couldn't do that anywhere else in the country. But in West Virginia, you gamble at 18. So we'd go to Charlestown and go and stay in the shitty Red Roof Inn in town and go and gamble at the casino there.
Yeah. I mean, when you say it like that, it makes sense. I mean, it's not too far from Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh,
no.
Ohio's, all those kind of places. So yeah, it definitely makes sense. And there was definitely some connections down there for a long time. So that's a good question. Definitely looking to Bill Lias and Paul Hankish and some of those guys. You'll definitely get some good information. All right, let's get into Tony Corallo, Tony Ducks Corallo on the sit down. Really looking forward to this one. Before we do that, I do, though, want to tell you about a new sponsor, Blackjack, and I'm very excited about this one.
Yep.
I want to tell you a little bit about Omerta Mia. You're probably asking me, what's Omerta Mia? Well, it's one of my favorite clothing brands out there, and it's truly perfect for what we have here on the sit down. It's a great clothing company that really specializes in honor, respect, and loyalty, and they put out some great clothes. They've got some great slogan tees, some great logo tees. They've got hats, stickers, artwork, sweatshirts, long tees, whatever you want. Really, for anyone that enjoys this kind of stuff, these things are perfect for you. They've got some great tees, particularly the definition of Omerta on a t-shirt, which I have and I've worn. They've got the fun police informants, stop glorifying rats, all sorts of great tees. Plus, they've got a cool Al Capone one and all sorts of different cool t-shirts. We're partnering with them. We urge you, go check out omertamia.com, omertamia.com, and get your stuff now. And if you go there now, let them know that we sent you and include promo code SITDOWN20 in the promo code box at checkout. You're going to get 20% off your whole order. So, you know, $100, you spend $100, you're going to get $20 off the top just because you listen to this show. I urge you as well. The clothes they sell are really well made. Not a lot of fading, really just well built, well good stuff. And you're going to like it. I know, Blackjack, you like Omerta Mia. I enjoy Omerta Mia. You should enjoy Omerta Mia as well. At least go get yourself a Stop Glorifying Rats shirt, because who likes rats?
I love their stuff. If you go on the website, omertamia.com, it is the stuff is just awesome, right? Like, it's awesome. The t-shirts, I want to buy about 10 of these at a time, right? Defund police informants, I love. You know, intimidate all witnesses, I get that. Laws only apply if you get caught, love that one. Yeah. Love that one. You know, they just have really cool stuff. The designs are great. The shirts are comfortable. They're really well done. If you go on this website and you listen to this podcast, you will find at least one thing that you love and have to have, and make sure you use the promo code SITDOWN20.
Yeah, go do that now. OmertaMia.com, code SITDOWN20. Support the show, get 20% off, and get some real good gear. And they got some long sleeves for the upcoming fall season. So go check them out. OmertaMia.com, code SITDOWN20. All right, let's get into Tony Ducks Corallo. A guy that I'm a big fan of, and we're going to get into some of his wiretap conversations. You talk about a guy that was caught on wiretap a lot. Tony Corallo was. Antonio Anthony Corallo was born February 12th, 1913 in East Harlem, New York. Not a lot's known about Tony Corallo's youth, though from what I know and from what I've researched and found out, Tony's father was a barber, and according to mob lore, he actually died in the 1919 flu pandemic, which, you know, a lot of people don't have, but something that I was able to recover. So Tony would kind of grow up without really a man in his life. He was a young kid when it happened, and, you know, he would really, like many mobsters, really early get into to misdeeds. He would work for a short time as a youth, as a tile setter. He was a young kid. He was a studious looking kid. He was short. He had sharp blue eyes. He wore glasses. But he was a guy that I think really needed a bit of a male influence in his life. Mm-hmm. As a youth, he would join the 107th Street Gang in the early 20s, which was a gang based in Harlem. And for anyone that doesn't know, the 100th Street Gang was actually formed by Tommy Lucchese and Lucky Luciano. And this was a gang that really worked as a farm team, really, for some of the crime families in the area. They were one of the first known gangs. Obviously, the Five Points Gang, you had all the different mobs. But this was a gang that did things. They were moving around, robbing people, committing burglaries. petty crime, really just a farm team for the crime families in the area. At 16 in 1929, Tony Corallo is arrested for grand larceny, but he's not convicted. And really throughout Tony's life, this would become a major similarity. He would never get really in trouble for anything. And that's something we found out with Vincent Gigante, but Tony Corallo would really do it his entire life. In the 20s and in his 20s, Tony would work for the Gagliano crime family under Tommy Lucchese, who was the underboss, and a guy called Johnny Dio. Johnny Dio was really, along with Lucchese, one of the first people that really perfected labor racketeering. They found out that if they controlled the different labor rackets, they could make tons of money. Tony Corallo would work under Johnny Dio in the Manhattan Garment District, and he'd really learn and understand unions and would really set him up for a long time, because he realized blackjack quickly that unions were where the money was. And when you controlled unions, you pretty much controlled everything.
Yeah. I mean, listen, this is something that's been going on in the mafia for decades now. And you're right. If you controlled a union, you controlled an industry, because the union controlled the workers, which controlled that business. So the way in was through the union. And this was, these guys were some of the first guys to do it, but you know, they were really kind of ahead of their time in doing it, right? Because nobody else was doing this at that point. And it was a way to dominate an entire industry at one point.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously down the road, this would be one of the real main reasons that things would happen down the road to Tony Corallo. But, you know, as we talked about, Tony Corallo really didn't have much of a father figure, and he really took to his mentor and kind of the guy that taught him a lot of things, Tommy Lucchese. Tommy Lucchese was important. He kind of looked at Tony as his pupil. And as I said, these are really the first of the kind that became racketeers. And this is exactly the kind of people, if you're Tony Corallo, you want to really learn under. And he quickly became a protege of Tommy Lucchese. In 1941, Tony Corallo would, though, get jammed up in something. He would be caught with $150,000 worth of heroin. The heroin was cut and ready for retail sales. He would be caught with the drugs and with thousands of dollars. And I think Tony, this was good for Tony, I think, at the end of the day, because I think from this day on, he realized the kind of trouble drugs could put you in. And I think from this day on, he really looked to kind of say, you know what, fuck drugs. I'm never going to get involved with them again. Tony would kind of beat the rap in a way again. He was found with all those drugs, Blackjack, and ended up only getting 6 months. Now, observers would believe that Tommy Lucchese probably used political ties plus some payoffs to get a light sentence for his protege. And you'd have to figure that one on, because Tony Corallo probably wouldn't have got only 6 months if not for Tommy Lucchese.
No. I mean, dude, $150,000 worth of heroin today gets you more than 6 months, way more than 6 months. So, yeah, for him to do that, there had to be some help. But, you know, a valuable lesson learned.
By 1943, Tony Corallo was only 30 years old, but he would become a made member in the Gagliano crime family. Tony would work out of Harlem initially, but once he became a capo, he would move his operation into Queens, and he would actually move his family as well up really towards Northern Flushing, Northern Queens, Whitestone, Malba, that area. And Tony would live there and operate out of that area. Between 1941 and 1960, Tony Corallo would be arrested 12 different times. And again, most of these charges were thrown out. He would be kind of adept at getting out of prosecution. And that's something that his mentor, Tommy Lucchese, would lament with. He would kind of give him the nickname Tony Ducks after one of his dismissals. Lucchese would say, Tony ducked again. From then on, he'd be named Tony Ducks. He could duck out of convictions, and he never really, Blackjack, had to pay much for anything he did. And it's something that really garnered him a new nickname. By moving his family into Queens, he would work directly with Johnny Dio, and they would begin to control most unions in New York, particularly the IBT, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And they would use what was called paper locals to get favorable deals. Now, paper local was a local that was really kind of defunct, basically, and they didn't have any paying members and they were kind of weak. They would kind of pick them up and start, quote, staffing them with our people. They would exploit the rank and file members and really just kind of take control of everything. And there were six or so that were really kind of in control of the family. They would also control other unions like the Conduit Workers Union, United Textile Workers, Brotherhood of Painters and Decorators, and many others. They were making a ton of money for the family. Why sell drugs? Why commit homicide when we can just control unions and really control the way of life for New Yorkers?
It's a much cleaner way of making a living. And the thing you alluded to before, Jeff, is truly astounding, right? That from 41 to 60, so a 19-year period, he's arrested 12 times. None of the cases even went to a trial. Like, the guy never even got to the point of having to face a jury. It's unbelievable how slippery Tony Corallo was. It's really unheard of in the guys we've talked about. We've talked about guys who have been arrested and have gone to trial. We've talked about guys who have never been arrested. We've never talked about a guy who has been arrested this many times and has just slipped through each time. It's so unheard of. And really, it's quite impressive.
Yeah, it really is. In fact, once we get to kind of the late 50s, the Teamsters are so controlled at this point by the mob, particularly in New York, that in September of 1957, the president of the Teamsters at the time, Dave Beck, would go to a convention in Florida where he would discuss that we should try to unseat these locals because they're so controlled by organized crime and Johnny Dio and Anthony Corallo, and that we need to look into these people. No one did. And they just, obviously Jimmy Hoffa would take control at some point and kind of control everything. But Joseph McCarthy, who we know who he is, a lot of people know who Joe McCarthy is, he would actually once call Tony Corallo one of the scariest and worst gangsters we've ever dealt with. And I think, I don't know if obviously that wasn't because Tony Corallo could kill or beat people up or was particularly menacing, but he was just a gangster. I think that was a lot different than what I think a lot of people knew of what a gangster was. He was smart. He was shrewd. And he was a guy that could control multiple different ways. And him and Dio had real control. Him and Lucchese, they all had real control of unions. And I think a lot of people were just terrified of that.
You're right about McCarthy, too, because the typical gangster is the guy like Capone, right? Like you have the picture in your head at that time of the guy out there with Tommy guns. Tony Corallo wasn't that. Tony Corallo was smarter than that, which made him a hell of a lot more dangerous and a hell of a lot more difficult to capture.
Exactly. And keep in mind, by this point in the mid to late 50s, this was now the Lucchese crime family. In 1951, Tommy Gagliano would die and Tommy Lucchese would take over the family. And obviously all this time, his main people were Johnny Dio, Tony Corallo. There were people that he was setting up to eventually take control of the family. Lucchese was 14 years older than Corallo. So Tony at some point would probably take over this family. In 1959, Tony Corallo would be called to testify at the U.S. Senate Select Committee for improper activities in labor and management. Really, the government wanted to understand why Corallo, according to them, was stealing $70,000 from the Teamsters Union. And they thought he was kind of in control of stealing. And like many other mobsters, as we know, he pled the fifth, and he pleaded the fifth over 120 times during the 2-hour interrogation.
You know what I have to say to that, Jeff?
Yeah, good for him.
Congratulations. Don't talk.
Yeah, that's your big thing. We need to get that on an Emerita shirt. In 1961, Tony would get jammed up, though. He would be arrested for trying to fix bankruptcy cases after he tried to bribe two Supreme Court justices to drop bankruptcy fraud cases with some of his associates. It didn't work. We saw this with Carmine Persico. It's probably not best to try to bribe high-end government officials. At that point, on August 2nd, 1962, Tony would be sentenced to 2 years in state prison. So another slap of the wrist for the most part. By this point, Tony Corallo had really just did about 3 years in prison his entire life. So not a bad trade-off for all that he had gotten.
Yeah.
So in the mid-60s, this is where things kind of get interesting for Tony Corallo. In July of 1967, his great friend Tommy Lucchese would die of a brain tumor. And the Lucchese crime family was really at a point where they had to figure out who would be the next boss of this family. And most people believed that Tony Corallo would be the guy. The problem that Tony had was he was in prison again. And a lot of this had to do with a scheme that he had come up with in 1966. So by this point, Tony Corallo is not only involved with unions, but he's starting to get in with government officials, fixing contracts, fixing bids in construction. And in 1966, an individual comes to the family and comes to Corral and says, "Hey, I want to borrow 10 G's. Okay. Tony says, "All right, you got to give us 40 back." So Tony's making a lot of money off this. But what he also has to do is fix government contracts. This guy just happens to be a guy called James Marcus. James Marcus was the New York City Department of Water Supply, Gas, and Electric Commissioner. And this guy was really in control of any and all contracts that had to do with water sources. And the day that he's made the commissioner, all of a sudden, there's an $835,000 emergency contract that's awarded to Tony Corallo's company without any emergency bidding. Tony makes a windfall off the kickbacks and all sorts of things involved with it. But down the road, this would be a big problem because not only would Tony Corallo get indicted for this, but so did James Marcus. In 1969, Tony would be convicted of conspiracy to bribe James Marcus and get 4.5 years. Not only did he get jammed up, but James Marcus did as well, and other individuals too. So by the point that Tony Corallo was supposed to be made next boss, they couldn't necessarily make him the boss because he was in prison. He was trying to get the Jerome Park Reservoir created and do all these things, but ended up putting him in prison. While in prison, the mob commission would designate that the acting boss of the family was a guy called Carmine Tremonti. Tremonti would just, though, be boss by name until Tony would get out of prison. Once Tony got out in 1970, he would be made official boss of the Lucchese crime family. You wouldn't have to worry much about Tremonti and a possible upheaval. In 1973, Tony found out that Carmine Tremonti would get 15 years in federal prison. So he was the boss, finally, in the 70s. And Blackjack really, you saw it all coming. He made the right relationships. He got involved with the right businesses, did the right things, and for the most part, really did very little prison time all the way to becoming the boss of one of the most powerful families in the country.
Yeah, I mean, he did a couple of years here and there, but I mean, ultimately, he skated on far more than they caught him for. And yeah, he set himself up really nicely in terms of the businesses that he controlled. He controlled major money-making enterprises, which, as you know, Jeff, when you're looking to ascend to that throne, that's a big point of importance. Is what you can bring to the table. And Tony Corallo could bring a lot to the table.
Now, obviously, during this time, Tony was the boss of the family. The underboss of the family at the time was a guy called Neil Migliore. Then eventually would be Tom McSantoro, who was a big-time drug dealer. Several other members of the family included Anthony Casso, Stephen Crea, Paul Vario, Jimmy Burke, all sorts of different people that were involved. But I think one thing that I will tell you about the Lucchese crime family, the problem that they had developed once Tony Corallo became the boss was there was never really anybody worthy once Tony would go away with being the next in line. And we've seen with other families, let's say the Gambinos or the Genoveses nowadays, where they have capable leadership. Some of the families that are not so capable at this point were because there really wasn't any good leadership after that. Tony Corallo is really, when it comes to the Lucchese crime family, he was really one of the last of the Mohicans, just because there just really wasn't anyone that could really shine his shoes to be the next in line. Some of the first moves Tony would do as he takes over the family was not only control of a union, but Tony and members of the commission truly wanted to control every piece of industry in New York, whether it was gravel, paving, garbage, steel, concrete, garments, clothing, fish, parking, you know, whatever. Anything that was done in New York, construction, they wanted to control. Tony would foray into gravel after he realized that there were major gravel companies that really he could influence. Paving was big. He would also get involved very much in more construction industries and unions. He also wanted to get into garbage. And as we know with garbage, that was a big thing as well. And there was a guy called Bernie Adelstein that would help him get into the private sanitation industry. And we obviously know this name. He would use the help of Paul Vario, who we all know the Vario crew is big in JFK and hijacking and that sort of thing. Tony Corallo Blackjack truly was in everything. This is how big the mob was. This is how much influence the mob has. There are people that just don't know. The mob literally controlled everything, every walk of life in New York.
Yeah, and I mean, you just talked about it, and people that maybe aren't from this part of the country or don't know a lot about this topic don't realize that the mafia controlled, as you said, every industry in Southern New York. I mean, New York City, Long Island, Westchester, any project that was done, whether it was building the Javits Center, whether it's picking up garbage, whether it's paving roads, these guys had a hand in all of it. All of it. I mean, it really is, when you think about the scale of this, Jeff, it's enormous. It's something that we can't comprehend today. Like, it is unfathomable that an organization had their hands so deeply in every facet of infrastructure in what is one of the most highly populated areas in the country. It's unbelievable that he was able to do this.
Now, obviously, keep in mind, during this time, the Concrete Club would be created, and that's where the five families would benefit off every yard of concrete that was poured. And this is what would really lead to part of the downfall for the Mafia Commission, as we know with the commission trial. The problem that Tony Corallo was starting to have, though, in the 70s and obviously now into the 80s, is the federal government was starting to get smarter. They were starting to wiretap people. They were starting to get conversations figured out. And what they first started doing, the feds, when it came to Tony Corallo, is they went to a guy that was involved in the garbage hauling industry, an individual called Robert Kubeka. Kubeka was a guy that was out on Long Island. He did not want to play ball with the mob and decides that, hey, instead of playing ball, I'm going to go to the feds and I'm going to wear a wire. Problem was, he couldn't really get to anyone. He couldn't get to anyone that mattered. He would try to get to Salvatore Avellino, who at the time was Corallo's right-hand man. He was his driver. He was one of his personal people, and he had a lot of sway in unions, Avellino. He could never get any information. So what the feds say is, okay, let's try to wiretap Avellino's house. Didn't get much of that. He didn't talk much. But then they find out that every day, like Furio would pick up Tony in The Sopranos, Avellino would pick Corallo up in his shiny Jaguar. And they had to believe that a lot of conversations were happening inside that Jaguar. So at one point, Avellino goes out to dinner with his wife. It's pouring down raining. And in 1983, the feds put a wire inside the dashboard of the Jaguar. And they hope that they get to sort of conversation. Now, initially, they weren't getting a ton of great conversation. Now, they would talk about everything. Mobsters would talk about food and sports and whatever. But then they started getting some really good conversations. And a couple of them, you know, Corallo and Avellino would lament about whether you should get your kids involved, that if the life's good enough for you, why isn't good enough for your kids? But then they started getting involved in conversations that really started to be a big problem, one of which involved unions. Now, at the time, one of the people involved with unions in New York was a guy called James Cody. Cody was a guy that controlled the IBT. He was a big mover and shaker in that union. And there was a wiretap that really kind of implicated everyone and really connected people. Corrales would discuss, or Avelino would discuss, that it seems like he don't want to. He says Cody was making a beef and complaining about that. That was theirs. Corrales would respond, let him go complain to Fat Tony. Again, let him go complain to Fat Tony. So what he's basically saying is this Cody's making a big fucking deal about things with different unions, and why is he getting involved? If he wants to make a big problem about it, tell him to keep it fucking from us and go to complain to Fat Tony, because Fat Tony's the guy that controls everything. Tony would then respond, listen to me, buddy. He's got to go complain to Fat Tony. What the fuck does he got to do with Carpenter? So what the feds are doing with these conversations is they're trying to point out that all these guys know each other. They're all part of one triumvirate. They're all making decisions. They all control unions. They all control unions. They all order murders. All that stuff's going on. So this was a treasure trove of information. At one point, Avelino discusses Blackjack exactly how they want unions to run. This is what I'm looking for, quote, you see, let's designate someone for that office. We want a delegate. That's our fucking union. It's not Jimmy Brown's union. It's not Paul Casana's union. They have theirs. We have ours. Let's take one of our sons or son-in-laws, put them in the office. They got a job. Let's take somebody's daughter. She's a secretary. Let's staff it with our people. All these conversations are particularly bad for the defense.
Yep. They're awful. I mean, it is the definition of building a RICO case, right? I mean, you're talking about a RICO case, you're talking about an enterprise. You're talking about things going on top to bottom from an organization that are criminal in nature. These tapes give you the predicate for a RICO case in a way that, like, you can't get any better if you're the government, right? This lays it out top to bottom.
We can call it John Gotti. We can call it all these guys that were caught on tape, but there weren't a lot of people that were caught this way on tape.
No, this hands the government a RICO predicate on the silver platter.
Right. And, you know, are there murders being done? Yeah. And if you go back and look at the commission, one of the driving forces for the commission getting a conviction was the killing of Carmine Galanti. And you can go back and look that up for yourself and how that connected to the commission. But they would also get Corrales talking about drugs. And, you know, this was something that, as we said, Tony Corrales did not want people selling drugs. In fact, he hated drugs. He would say, quote, I couldn't be any fucking plainer than I was with some of these guys, because I don't want nobody fucking around with junk. They've got to be killed. That's all. Fuck this shit. You cannot be in the narcotics business and flat on your stomach. You've got to be exposed to it. You've got to go out on the street. You've got to sell it. You can't be in the junk business without going out in the fucking streets and selling this cock-sucking shit. We should kill them. We should make some examples. All right? All right? Pretty bad. Pretty out there. And we all know what he meant there. Okay? Yeah, we don't need a translator to figure that out.
No, if you're a federal prosecutor, this is gold. It's solid gold, because he is clearly the boss of this operation. He's clearly laying down the rules, and he's clearly in charge of what the rest of them are doing. It again is a RICO case on a silver platter. That's what he handed them on these tapes.
On February 25th, 1985, it would all come crashing down for Tony Corrales. He and other mob leaders were indicted in the Mafia Commission trial. But Tony was a little lucky. He was in the hospital at this point and wasn't arrested until a few days later. Keep in mind, not only was he arrested, but people in his family as well, including Salvatore Tom Mick Santoro and his consigliere, Christopher Christie Tick Funari, who we talked about as the protege, or the mentor of Anthony Casso. Keep in mind, once Corrales gets arrested, this goes back to the whole problem of who is the successor here. Yep. Because obviously Santoro, Funari, we're all probably going away. Who's going to be next in line? And according to journalists and people that have written about this, a meeting would be held at Funari's home after awaiting trial, where Corrala would tell Funari that, quote, he wanted the capo of Funari's old crew, Vic Amuso or Anthony Casso, as his successor. Keep in mind, Funari, Amuso, and Casso would meet in separate rooms, and ultimately it was decided Amuso would take control. I will say, I've always had trouble believing this, but again, I find it also difficult because who the hell of your Tony Corrala would you pick? I mean, I don't know.
Listen, what you're going to say here is the God's honest truth. Both of these guys are horrible choices. Like, the idea of Anthony Gaspipe Casso being the boss of a family is it blows your fucking mind. And if you don't know why, go back and listen to our episode on Anthony Gaspipe Casso. Vic Amuso is no better. If these are your two best choices, you don't have a good choice.
Yeah, and, you know, I will say it's a shame Paul Varia went to prison because I think Paul could have been decent. I mean, I could be wrong there.
Better than either one of these guys.
Yeah, but according to people, Corrala reportedly wanted Amuso, but that he would be okay if it was Casso as well. Quote, that it was kind of in good hands either way. But listen, again, once Corrala went away, and this was such the problem with the commission, it truly destroyed the mafia because these were really some of the last of the Mohicans as far as gangsters were concerned, true leaders were concerned, and the rest that were coming up just weren't good enough.
No.
January of 1987, after being convicted, Tony Corrala was sentenced to 100 years in prison and got $240,000 fine. Keep in mind, Tony Corrala would live about 13 years, though. He wouldn't die till 2000 after he would die of natural causes at the Federal Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. He would be 87 years old. So he lived a pretty long life, spent about 20 of it in prison. And when we look at the Lucchese family today, you know, I think when it really comes down to it, it really was never the same after Tony Corrala went away. They've had some success. I mean, they've had some interesting guys and whatever, but you know, Casso was a complete mess. Amuso, really, if you look at the triumvirate, is still the boss, according to a lot of people, even though he's in his 80s. I've heard Vic Amuso is trying to get home, as far as I know, but I don't think that will work. It's just a mess of a family, like most of them now. Tony Corrala was really the last of his kind. He truly ruled through a iron fist, but he was huge in racketeering. He was huge in labor rackets. He was huge in controlling unions, having government connections, doing what you had to do to get those connections. And that's where the real money came from. Keep in mind, Tony was an interesting guy. According to most people, he had a really nice house in Oyster Bay Cove, New York. He had a son and a daughter. He was married. He loved gardening and opera and good pasta, according to him. Sounds like a nice group of things there. Gardening and pasta. Sounds nice.
I don't know about the gardening, but I'll take the pasta.
But you're not a gardener? No?
No, Jeff, I'm not a gardener.
I think down the road in my 60s and 70s, that's something I'll do. Like have tomatoes.
I don't have patience for it. I don't have patience.
Yeah, my dad's a gardener. He has a garden, which I like. So, but yeah, Corrala was a fascinating guy. He's a guy that a lot of people forget about. But he was truly someone that was just like a lot of the other guys we've talked about recently, whether it was Anthony Salerno or Vincent Gigante. You know, these guys were powerful and rich and wealthy because of their ability to not only, you know, be forceful, but they controlled unions. They controlled everything. And here's what's interesting, Blackjack, and I'll pose this question to you. If you are going to lament Paul Castellano, how do you not lament Corrala? They're the same people, gangster-wise. None of them were in the streets. They were big in unions. They were big in white-collar stuff. They did what they had to do if they had to kill people. But I've never heard anyone say, Corrala was a bad guy, and he wasn't. Paul just had a really bad couple of years at the end.
I think that Paul had a different personal side to him in terms of you know, we talked in this episode about Tony Corallo being very anti-drug and what led to that early in his life. Paul Castellano said the same thing, but he did something different, right? Paul said don't deal drugs, but he was okay profiting off of drugs. Paul's a little bit of a hypocrite. I also think that Paul insulated himself to an extent that you didn't see from Tony Corallo. Paul made everything difficult for everyone around him based on his convenience and what he thought was best. I don't get that same vibe off Tony Corallo. So I think you're right that there are similarities between them in terms of they're both kind of white collar gangsters, but I think Paul Castellano personally was more abrasive to people.
When it comes to gangsters, Tony Corallo will never be Carlo Gambino or even Salerno, who was a friend, or Tony Accardo or anything like that. But he was just a really good leader. He's a really good gangster, made a lot of money. He's, I think, probably as far as greatest boss. I mean, he's got to be top 15. I mean, he's definitely there. He's not Tommy Lucchese. He's not Carlo Gambino, but he was a really good boss. And for, you know, really 13 years controlled this family. You know, maybe more towards even 15 years if you give him the boss title right out of prison. He was a really good boss, made a lot of money, and really did the mob the right way and really didn't go to prison until, you know, the last 10 or so years of his life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the guy is definitely, he was a quality leader, and I think he did a good job. But, you know, he had his flaws like most do. And ultimately it led to his demise. The same thing that does the most, talking. Just don't talk.
Yeah, was definitely the king of the wiretaps. He was always on wiretaps, a lot of conversations. And, you know, there was another good wiretap I want to tell you about Blackjack. It was a brief one, but I got this out of one of my favorite books. It's by James Good. It's called Wiretap, Listening in on America's Mafia. And you'll get a kick out of this. So one time in the Jaguar, Avellino says to Corallo, "What happened there? Tuesday, though, we have to go meet with Paul Castellano." Corallo just responds with, "That fucking cocksucker? Question mark."
I mean, listen, you get no complaints from me there. I don't like Paul.
So I think when we look back on everything, it seems like everyone hated Paul.
Not a big fan of Paul.
But they put up with him because he was powerful. And, you know, that really, I think, concludes, at least for the 20th episode, that is our first season of the show. And it really concludes the commission group. You know, we did Salerno, we did Castellano, we did Tony Dux. I guess we'll have to do Gennaro Langella, who was kind of a lower end guy, but, you know, was on that as well. But, you know, we've done a lot of heavy hitters. We've done a lot of the hitmen. We've done some drug gang guys. We've just got so many still to do. So I've had a great time with the show. I love doing it each week. I'm so happy with it. And seems like people are enjoying it as well. We have a little bit of an army, if you will. We have a family of our own here. The what do we call this? The Sit Down Crime family or something. But we want to thank Thrive Fantasy. We want to also thank Omerta Mia. Go check out the app Thrive Fantasy if you're into prop betting style fantasy. And football's coming around, so make sure you get that. And also go check out omertamia.com, promo code SITDOWN20. Get yourself some money off of the great threads they have. Blackjack, another show. Another show's over. Got another one next week. Thanks for coming on, man. Always good talking to you.
Brother, my favorite hour of the week. Always something learned, always an interesting conversation. I love it.
Couldn't agree more. As always, go check us out on Twitter at TheSitDown7. And make sure, if you're checking us out on Spotify or iTunes, you got a chance to review us, give us 5 stars. Make sure you do that. Let us know that you enjoy the show and what you want to hear coming up. As always, I am Jeff Nadeau. He's Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.